Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez is running for Congress. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Jimenez is in his final year of office. He touts his 9 years as mayor as a great era for the county and the region. We'll ask him about the region's affordable housing crisis, the challenges facing public transportation, and we'll get his thoughts on today's impeachment vote. Also, Diane Rehm went from talk show host to advocate for access to end-of-life medication.
So many people don't even want to talk about death.
Rehm talked with us about the stories that she collected for her book, as well as ways to talk about death, even with strangers. We'll tell you about death cafes. Finally, Miami-Dade commissioners are all in agreement that they want to change the name of Dixie Highway. But what will be the new name? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez is term limited out. He's going to be leaving office this year. Now, recently, he had his final State of the County address, and he pointed to a decade of economic growth, low unemployment, and a turnaround in the housing market. Now, still, our region does face some major affordable housing challenges, and our public transit infrastructure is in need of repair. Jimenez recently turned his attention to, by the way, for his run for Congress. He's going to be running in the District 26 against incumbent Democrat Debbie McCarcel Powell. Mayor Jimenez joins me again in studio. Mayor, such a pleasure always.
It's always a pleasure to be here, man.
Let me start with this. Let's start with the most recent, actually, event, the big event that we had here in Miami-Dade, which was, of course, the Super Bowl, the 11th time that we've hosted the game. And I wanted to ask you about this. When do you think we're going to know how we profited off this and how much Miami-Dade County made, really made?
Well, the people of Miami-Dade County, the residents of Miami-Dade County, the businesses of Miami-Dade County, we'll get that fairly soon. We know right off the bat that the hotel rates were at probably historical highs. $550 per night was the average, not only just Miami Beach, but entire Miami-Dade. That's really high. I think the occupancy rates were somewhere around 90%. And so that they did very, very well. And I'm sure that our shops and our restaurants, our hotel rooms did great. Our Uber and Lyft drivers did really well. And so we're going to put that together. We figure this is going to be, look, the last time we had it 10 years ago, when they actually did the numbers, it was over about $230 million of economic impact.
That was over 10 years.
That's over 10 years ago. And so now when you add that this is a much bigger event, much more people come for the Super Bowl. Not only, you know, I know you only have about 65,000 to get into the game, but we figured about 150,000 were actually going to come to for the events and everything that's happening around the Super Bowl. We figured that this is going to be, you know, north of $400 million, probably close to $500 million of economic impact in Miami-Dade.
Now, I mean, I hear that number. The NFL likes to push that. Mm-hmm. But look, last week we spoke with Victor Matheson from Holy Cross. He's an economist, a sports economist. He said, you know what, it's never really as much as they say, but this is what he said.
When it comes to the economic benefit, you have to decide, well, what's going to happen when the Super Bowl's here versus what would actually happen during a normal day or a normal weekend in Miami. And since Miami's such a good tourist destination in early February anyway, your hotels were likely to be pretty full of tourists with full wallets willing to spend money here. And therefore, the Super Bowl actually displaces a lot of activity that would have occurred anyway.
He's saying Miami, this time of year, Miami does well anyway. Mm-hmm. Super Bowl really right. Wouldn't have added much more.
I doubt it. Like I said, last 10 years ago, the impact was $230 million. That was done by economists here. And so when you just add inflation, plus the fact that it's a much bigger event and the room rates are at historical highs, we may have had, you know, 60, 70, 80% occupancy versus the 80 or 90% that we had, but you wouldn't be able to charge those rates that we got for the Super Bowl.
One of the other things that he did point out, too, was that, you know, yes, hotels are going to do better, businesses will do better, but will the workers get to see that? Because their salaries or their rates are not going to go up.
Well, anytime that you have a hotel is doing well, then they have to either hire more workers or eventually, you know, that will get down. In terms of our restaurants and our shops, anytime, like, I mean, if that were the case, then hey, you know, don't have anybody here, because then you know they'd still be paid and all that. That doesn't work that way. And so, the economic benefit flows eventually into the pockets of the people that are working there, and then it flows into the neighborhoods, because those are our neighbors that are actually working there. I already talked about Uber and Lyft. That directly goes into their pocket. And I know that the rates for Uber and Lyft were really pretty high during some of these events. So, yeah, the economic impact will be somewhere north of $400 million. We had events at Bayfront Park. We had events over at the convention center. We had tens of thousands of people that were here. And I know you have the naysayers, but I'm going to tell you right now, I could feel it. I could feel the activity. I could feel the excitement. And there's one other thing that he doesn't mention, okay? That, yeah, maybe in March or in February, we may have some people here, but we don't have the attention of the world for a whole week. And we don't have the value of those images coming from Miami and Miami-Dade County. This beautiful weather, this beautiful city, the excitement, the beautiful, you know, the diversity of our people, and the word Miami was on everybody's lips for at least, you know, a week and more.
We got lucky. Saturday weather was really bad.
It
cleared up.
Fantastic.
For Sunday.
Fantastic. Are you a naysayer? I mean,
no.
You sound like you're
really kind of negative
on this.
I have to be the other voice.
No, I
have to be the other voice.
Well, look.
If I had him here, he would do it.
Look, we planned for that bad weather on Saturday just to make it so spectacular on Sunday.
Well, there you go.
There wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was 65 degrees. It was, you know, Chamber of Commerce.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that you have the power to change the weather?
Well, no, but don't worry. We were. Worked it out, okay? So we knew. Well, look, we were lucky on that. But
yes, you were.
But
what about this? Let me ask you this: Stephen Ross gave you a couple of tickets to the game. Did you go?
No, I did go. And so what happened there was I asked for a ethics opinion as to whether I could accept the tickets, and the ethics opinion came back that yes, I could accept the tickets. I had official duties there. But my wife didn't, and so I accepted one ticket because I had official duties, and I purchased my wife's ticket. So the reports that you got on Friday was premature. I had asked for, okay, what are the options to this? I had some interviews.
Stephen Ross had offered tickets to a number of people.
Yes.
On the commission. Okay.
Right.
You end your term this year.
Mm-hmm.
You said recently in your final state of the county as being part of a great turnaround.
Yep.
In your mind, what was your biggest achievement over the last decade?
Leaving Miami-Dade County in much better condition than when I got it in 2011. In 2011, our unemployment rate was around 12%.
It was right after the housing crash.
It was the housing crash, yeah. The housing prices were actually, housing prices and home prices were going down. We were in the midst of a $400 million budget deficit. And so, you know, we took the reins of control of Miami-Dade County, and we made some difficult decisions to tighten our belts like everybody else in this town was tightening their belts, and we were able to turn this around. We made investments to bring technology and entrepreneurship and diversify the economy here of Miami-Dade County. We also finished some major projects with culture to, again, attract different investments in Miami-Dade County. And so now our unemployment rate is hovering around 2%. We have diversified the economy of Miami-Dade County, and the government itself. We have restored all the cuts that we made back in 2011. We had the largest tax cut in Miami-Dade County history. We saved the people of Miami-Dade County just on taxes, property taxes alone, close to $2 billion. We saved them another $2 billion in refinancing costs during the life of my term so far. Talking to people that came for the Super Bowl, they're saying, I can't believe this place. And so, you know.
Well, real quick, you told me you had the economic crash, but there was a nationwide rebound. So can speak to me about what you did here locally.
Our nationwide rebound here was bigger. Our local rebound was more and bigger than normal, because normally we run here about a 1% above the national average in unemployment. Right now we're averaging about a point below the national average in unemployment. You have seen the amount of investments and the amount of construction that's happened here in Miami-Dade County. And it's because, A, they have a stable government. People want to invest here. B, it's our diversity, our geography, the investments that we've made in our airport and our seaport to make us a logistics center, the investments that we made in order to turn us into a tech center. We're the number one city, according to the Kauffman Foundation, for startups in the United States. We're working on scalability, and we're getting more and more hedge funds to come and locate down here, angels, so that our companies that are being started here in Miami-Dade County are going to grow. And again, you know, this doesn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident.
I'm talking with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez in his final year in office. Again, he recently did announce his campaign for Congress. But if you have a question for the mayor about the Super Bowl, his priorities, anything that's next, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. You can also find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's talk about housing. Yes, the housing market bounces back, but we are living in a market right now where affordable housing is still one of the hardest things to come by. Lots of luxury developments always happening, but you got a lot of working class people here. And this is, look, a big part of our economy, as you already know, I'm not telling you something you don't know, is service. And that's not going, even if we boosted the minimum wage, that's still going to make it very hard for people to find housing. Okay, so how about that part of it?
We have embarked on rehabbing a lot of the aging stock that we have. Look, one of the projects that I'm proudest of is the Liberty Square project, where we turned 700 public housing units into 1,500 combination public housing units and affordable and workforce housing units. We've got 4,000 housing units that are on the drawing board now for the complex that was called Robert King High Towers. And so we have a number of units that are for elderly, but we're going to add another 4,000 units there. We are now working on Calmer Place and Calmer Gardens, where right now there's a couple of hundred units there. We know that we can get up to 800 units there of affordable and workforce housing and public housing. And working with our federal partners, we plan on making good on promises to have 10,000 housing units starts, before November. And so, government isn't the answer. We don't have all the answers to all the problems. We do have make the conditions so that we can improve our quality of life. So I would expect also that the private sector would need to step in.
What about this part then?
Yeah.
Transit.
Go ahead.
How much
of it's on government? I love these questions because, it's good.
And you've been on talking about this again. Okay. So, I mean, look, at the very beginning, it was about more rail, but then you've switched and you're like, we need more buses.
No, I haven't. I did not switch.
Okay? You want more buses.
No.
Rapid transit buses.
No. So let me tell you exactly what I want. Okay. So in South Dade, I want bus rapid transit because the rail line there would be way, way too expensive. And the ridership you can't justify the cost of the rail. So we're going to do what's called BRT, gold standard BRT. It's going to look like a rail. It's going to act like a rail. And we've talked about that. But here's what we're doing. We have an RFP out right now for a connection between Miami Beach and the city of Miami.
I want to ask you about that.
No,
yes.
No problem. That is a rail project. It's either going to be Metro Mover, or it'll be some kind of a monorail system. We don't know yet because we haven't gotten the responses back yet. We penned an agreement with Virgin Trains, and we're going to build a train station over in Aventura, and we're in negotiations to build some more train stations on that line between downtown Miami and Aventura, so that we can now have commuter rail on the what now is being operated by Virgin. We're about to embark on an RFP for the North Line, and that's going to be an elevated system, maybe rubber tired, maybe rail, depends on what the responses are. In terms of the East-West corridor, the MDX finished a dedicated bus lane on the 836 that we're going to activate in the next couple of months with Miami-Dade County, and have express buses that can take you from a parking ride into downtown Miami, bypassing all of the traffic. And so, we've made some progress, and we're really moving forward.
What about the issue of traffic? I mean, there was a recent survey from TomToms on traffic congestion. We're the sixth worst. And here we are right outside from us, right over here towards downtown. We're about to expand the 836 and make it a double-decker road.
Yes.
I mean, you know, are we doing enough? Is it just about expanding roads? Because
it's about everything.
We've seen that hasn't really...
It's about everything.
But congestion hasn't gotten better.
No, because we've got more people. Okay, so you have more people coming here. And by the way, like I said, I think...
But ridership is down.
I know. So we're something else that we're doing is that we're working with the Transit Alliance to come up with a different system for our buses. So,
right.
So we get our and make it more efficient and much less political. That process is ongoing right now. And so there you talked about traffic. Right now we have on my desk is ready for me to sign is the contract to convert all of the traffic signals in Miami-Dade County to intelligent adaptive traffic signals. Not only are they going to be intelligent and adaptive, but in the future they'll be predictive, so that when they'll communicate with a car and say, you need to go here, you need to go there, you need to go there, here, here, to get here faster. We expect a 15% increase in the efficiency of the roads that we already have with that system. And so this is not one silver bullet. And this is where I have to disagree with some people. They say, build more mass transit, build more mass transit, build more mass transit. No, you build more mass transit, but you also have to build capacity in the roads. And you also have to squeeze out as much efficiency from the roads that you have, because still, after we build it all out, all right, more than 90% of the people will still be on some kind of personal vehicle. And so you've got to do all of the above.
Because of time, I want to ask you about the project to build possible rail from Miami to Miami Beach.
Right.
It's either monorail or a Metro Mover type system.
Right, or a BRT. It's still on the table.
What do you think? If you could have your way, what do you think is the best way?
I am not going to talk about it, because there's an RFP. We have something that's called a cone of silence. And so we want to wait for the responses. The things I can say, let's wait for the responses, and it'll be evaluated by the administration. And then whatever we decide or we think is the best option, it'll be taken to the commission, and then the commission will have the final say on what we do there.
I wanted to get to, you are running for Congress in District 26.
Mm-hmm.
The thing, too, is that it's not just parts of Miami, but also Monroe County.
Mm-hmm.
What do you understand about the challenges that folks there are facing?
The folks in Monroe County are really interested about the environment, and my record on the environment, it's pretty good. And we were the first county in the nation to have a resiliency officer. We have a chief resilience strategy that we've developed here in Miami-Dade County. We're the only county to be a 100 Rockefeller, city, environmental city, in conjunction with the city of Miami and Miami Beach. In fact, though, Miami-Dade County actually takes the lead on that. Our budget is based upon around resiliency. We've taken, our focus is on climate change and sea level rise. We know that we're the tip of the spear for that. There are other issues down in Monroe County that they're concerned about. They're concerned about plastic, and they're concerned about all of the waste that basically is flowing down into the Keys. They're concerned about the quality of the coral reefs down there, so that they can maintain their lifestyle. So we talked about the suntan lotions and what's it doing to coral reefs down in the Keys, and they're also worried about the Keys and ecosystem is tied a lot to the Everglades, and so they're worried about that, and so which I'm worried about too.
In this, compared to past races, now it gets very partisan. You're a Republican,
sure.
How do you change your strategy and how you're, how you operate now that becomes a part of the race?
Well, look, my opponent makes it easy because she's so partisan,
you have to be too.
Hold on a second. I can be. I have demonstrated to be very nonpartisan. Okay, do I have to be partisan? I am a Republican. Yeah, absolutely. Am I going to disagree with my opponent on a number of things? Absolutely. She's way too far to the left. I don't think that she represents the interests and the values of the people of Florida 26. I'm being more in the center, more of a moderate. I think I represent those too, and I have demonstrated the ability to work with Democrats and independents and Republicans to get things done here in Miami-Dade County, I'll do the same thing when I get to Congress.
You recently greeted President Trump when he was here in South Florida. Mm-hmm. Well, now he lives in South Florida,
right?
Permanently. Are you aligning yourself with the president?
I'm certainly aligning myself with his policy, economic policies. Yesterday's numbers and what he put out yesterday were
during the State of the Union.
Absolutely, they were incredible numbers. The lowest unemployment rate, average unemployment rate in the history of the United States. African Americans, the lowest unemployment rate in their history. Hispanic Americans, the lowest unemployment rate in their history. The number of jobs for women has been, I think they're getting 73% of new jobs in the United States. I don't know how many millions of people have come off the welfare rolls, how many millions of people have come off food stamps, and I think that the country is heading in the right direction. I certainly agree with his policies towards China and that we needed to have a much better trade agreement with China. I think they were eating our clock and have been eating our clock for decades, and so I'm very happy with what he's doing there. Killing Soleimani in Iraq was a good thing, the number one terrorist in the world. So yeah, there are a lot of good things that he's done that I certainly will align myself with.
I'm going to bring you back in, obviously, as we talk about that race. But again, Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez in his final year in office, again, announcing his run for Congress. Mayor Jimenez, always a pleasure. We'll have you back.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. By the way, just a note, Congresswoman Debbie McCarthy Powell, the incumbent, is expected to join us tomorrow. But we'll be talking about impeachment and other things. Still to come, should the terminally ill be able to access end-of-life drugs? Our conversation with former NPR host Diane Rehm is next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. What is a good death? This is a question former NPR host Diane Rehm has thought a lot about.
My idea of a good death is one that is without suffering, is with my family and dear friends around me. I have a chance to say goodbye to each and every one, to tell them exactly what they mean to me.
Rehm has become an advocate for access to end-of-life medication. She was inspired to advocate for the Death with Dignity movement after her late husband, John Rehm, battled Parkinson's disease for 10 years. We'll hear more of that story. Rehm's new book, When My Time Comes, features interviews with doctors, patients, advocates, and critics of the Death with Dignity movement. The interviews were also filmed and will later become a documentary for PBS. Rehm will be in South Florida tomorrow for an event at Miami-Dade College. She spoke with WLRN producer Chris Remington about the book and how we can inspire conversations around death.
Aid in Dying is a very personal issue for you. Can you first define, when we talk about aid in dying, what that exactly means?
Medical aid in dying is when someone is very ill, either from cancer, from stroke, from heart disease, and two doctors, and this is by law, must determine that that individual is within 6 months of death. Then, after a number of days, if that person continues to wish medical aid in dying, a prescription is written and usually held by the doctor, but in some cases given to the patient when he or she has signed all the documents and has made clear his or her wishes. At the time of death, that individual must be able to self-administer the medication.
Your late husband, John Rehm, suffered from Parkinson's disease for 10 years, and at some point, the two of you came together with the decision that he was ready to die, and he didn't have a lot of options. Can you explain the circumstances he was in and that you guys were working on together?
John Rehm was in a nursing home in Maryland, no longer able to feed himself, to toilet himself, to stand on his own. He could do nothing for himself. And one day, having lived in this situation for at least a few months, he finally said to me, "I'm ready to die." And I said, "Well, wait a minute, are you sure? Is that really what you want?" And he said, "I'm absolutely sure. So what I'd like you, Diane, to do is to call our daughter, who is a physician in Boston, to call our son, have him here tomorrow, and the doctor who is caring for me here at this facility. I'd like them all here. I'd like to be able to talk to all of you at once." Mm. And so we met, and John said to the doctor, "I am ready to die, and I want you to help me." And the doctor, of course, in Maryland, which at that time did not have any law allowing medical aid in dying, said, "John, I understand, I sympathize, I totally get it, but I cannot help you. Either lawfully or ethically, I cannot help you." And my daughter on the phone from Boston hollered into the phone, "But Dad, we can keep you comfortable." And he said, "Damn it, I don't want comfort. I am ready to die." Honestly, Chris, I had never in the past year seen John Rehm look so happy and healthy. I said, "My gosh, you look absolutely wonderful." And he said, "I have begun the journey. I've had nothing to eat, I have had nothing to drink, and I am ready to die."
You spoke with such a diverse group of people for the book. Dan Diaz is a name some might recognize. His late wife, Brittany Maynard, had terminal brain cancer. She was 29 years old, and the two of them moved from California to Oregon for access to end-of-life drugs. How did Brittany's story capture such national attention and invigorate the conversation about access to end-of-life drugs?
Oh, Chris, she was so young, so vibrant, so beautiful. We went out to California to film with her husband, Dan Diaz. And Brittany was, you know, they had just been married for such a short time. And she began having those terrible, terrible headaches and was diagnosed with brain cancer. They operated on what they thought was going to be a very small cancer, but it turned out to be much, much larger. At first, they thought she'd have 3 to 5 years to live. Afterwards, they said to her, she only had 3 months to live. And so they decided to move to Oregon from California to uproot themselves from family, from friends, from work, in order to establish a 30-day residency, as was required by Oregon, to rent a home, to live as best they could while Dan commuted back and forth to keep up his work. And finally, she told the world, and of course, People Magazine and every other news media outlet was focused on Brittany Maynard. And on November 1st of that year, she did use medical aid in dying because she woke up that morning and had another terrible seizure. This brain tumor was causing seizures, and she never knew when they would happen or how they would happen, but they were very, very painful for her. And so she did. She took her life on November 1st of that year. And Dan Diaz has really devoted his life, as she asked him to do, to publicize medical aid in dying and to, as I am doing, encouraging other state legislators to take the wishes of their citizens seriously.
Her story really illustrates the diversity in terms of the different types of end-of-life patients and experiences. I wanted to chat with you about the story of Lori Wallace Pushinatus and Dr. Catherine Sonquist Forrest. You interviewed them for the book. And when Lori's breast cancer metastasized and was considered terminal, Dr. Forrest committed to being with her throughout what they thought would be her last 6 months. So I'm curious, how the relationship between doctors and patients has changed because of access to end-of-life drugs, especially when you think about patients' desires for what they want in their final stages of life.
Lori, as soon as she found out that she had cancer, and she did have the BRCA gene, as I recall, both her mother and her aunt had had breast cancer. So she knew she was likely to develop the BRCA gene. And when she did, as soon as she found out that she had done that, she said to her doctor, "I want to be on that medical aid in dying list. I want you to record that I have said this right now, early on." Now, in the end, she did not, even though she had the drugs, she did not use them. She went peacefully in hospice without making use of the drugs. And her doctor supported her through every step of the way. You're quite right, Chris. Medical aid in dying has changed the relationship between patient and doctor in those states where it's allowed and in those situations where doctors themselves support the patient. Now, there are many, many doctors who don't agree that a doctor's role is to help a patient die. They see the Hippocratic Oath they've taken as a pledge to do everything they can to do no harm. And they see helping a patient die as doing harm.
And I think it's important that we get to that, because you did hear from a variety of critics of these end-of-life laws in the book. In particular, we heard from Dr. William Toffler, the National Director for Physicians for Compassionate Care in Oregon. Now, there haven't been any documented cases in the U.S. of people being taken advantage of through these laws, but Toffler argued to you that doctors aren't always required to be present when the patient is taking the end-of-life medication, and they often aren't. So can there be concerns that as more states move forward with these laws that allow patients to use end-of-life drugs, there's a greater chance for abuse to happen?
I do remember vividly talking with Dr. Toffler and hearing him say he had heard from other doctors that perhaps something had gone wrong, that doctors were being forced, but there has not been a single documented case of this happening. So all I can tell you is that of those patients in Oregon and elsewhere who've been given the drugs, who have said that they want medical aid in dying, 1/3 have decided at the end of their lives that as long as they had the drugs, they were fine. That meant that they had control, but they decided not to use the drugs. And I think that's marvelous because what it shows is that the person had a choice, the person made that choice, and either used the drugs or did not.
I'm speaking with Diane Rehm, former longtime NPR host. Her new book is called When My Time Comes. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So you're going to be traveling to Miami this week. You'll be here on Thursday, and I'm sure you're well aware Florida has one of the largest senior citizen populations in the country. And as more seniors continue to retire here in South Florida, Broward County has raised concerns about the needs and the lack of healthcare infrastructure available for these seniors. So how do you see the issue of palliative care and end-of-life options becoming a real policy concern in the coming years down here?
I think it's not only Florida, the entire country is aging. If you believe that God should be the only decider, I support you 100%. If you want every single element that medical science can provide, I support you 100%. And if you are asking for control over the time and place and manner of your own death, if you are within 6 months of death, I support you 100%. If you say to a doctor, I want medical aid in dying. Now, it's the Florida legislature that's going to have to take this up. And it will be, I think, as the result of pressure from citizens, not only older ones who do not wish to suffer through painful last stages of illness, but it will be younger people in middle age who see their parents suffering. It has been said we're all only one bad death away from asking for medical aid in dying. To see someone suffer, Chris, as I have, both in my husband and my mother, is to absolutely convince me that I would like to have control over the end of my life.
And since you mentioned the Florida legislature, in fact, death with dignity legislation is being presented for the first time. Democrat Kevin Rader from Boca Raton has brought that legislation forward.
Well, I hope that this book will, in fact, embolden some of those legislators to seriously consider whether they, as civil servants, should decide whether my husband, who is a resident of Florida, should have control over his life or whether he should have control over his own life.
Your book ends with a conversation between you and your grandson, Benjamin. You ask him to record the conversation on his iPhone and then explain in detail your request for end-of-life care so it's on the record and for him to share with the family. To be open, this was a difficult chapter for me to get through. I lost my mother to cervical cancer 9 years ago this September.
Oh, Chris, I'm so sorry.
The cancer, thank you. It progressed very quickly, and she was young, 53, so we had very few opportunities to discuss her end-of-life wishes. But ultimately, we were at her bedside when she died because she chose a similar path to your husband, a death at home rather than continuing medication and hospital treatment. So I'm wondering what advice you would give to listeners about starting these difficult conversations with loved ones about how they want their life to end.
I think if you are in your 50s and or 60s and you're talking with a parent who might be in his or her 80s or 90s, you might begin the conversation by talking about what you are thinking about for yourself rather than asking outright, what do you want at the end of your life? In the same way, my late husband, John Rehm, and I talked with our children about what we wanted at the end of our lives. So they both knew how we felt.
But I'm wondering if you found there was tension or issues when you had those conversations with your children.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The kids were uncomfortable.
Mm.
Of course. But nevertheless, they became more comfortable as we were able to talk about the issue more and more in realistic terms. And that was why, at the end, I think our daughter Jenny spoke from her place as a physician by saying, "Dad, we can keep you comfortable." I mean, that was her medical side speaking. But now doctors, young doctors, are learning about medical aid in dying. They're becoming more open than those doctors who were educated 10, 20, 25 years ago. It's changing, Chris, and it's changing for the better.
That was WLRN producer Chris Remington speaking with former NPR host Diane Rehm. You can find details about her event in Miami tomorrow and hear a longer version of the interview, which includes a discussion about death cafes. Just go to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, the debate about changing the name of a road and its link to the Confederacy. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Dixie Highway is one of the oldest roadways in the country. It runs along US 1 and stretches through different states. In Miami-Dade County, some say the name Dixie is tied to a racist history, and it's associated with the Confederacy. Across the country, conversations around what to do with Confederate symbols are continuing to play out. Leaders in South Florida want to rename the highway. Commissioner Dennis Moss is one of them. He represents South Miami-Dade, and he's proposing a bill that would rename the highway. At a commission meeting on Tuesday, Moss received big support from other Miami-Dade commissioners to do that. Now, we've made multiple requests for Commissioner Moss to join us on the program over the past couple of weeks, but he has been unavailable. Now, the debate is happening to the north in Broward County as well, and we talked recently with Broward County Mayor Dale V.C. Holness, one of the supporters of the name change. He wants people to understand how that name has impacted his community. What was your first exposure to the highway and to this issue?
You know, we knew for a long time the connotation of Dixie as it pertains to the black community, slavery, the bad treatment that blacks got throughout this country over time. And it goes back to Dixie more or less as a symbol in terms of name. It's tied to that oppression. Though the symbol is very tainted, very hurtful for a lot of people, there are a lot of other activities that I have engaged in over time in order to empower the black community, because I believe that true empowerment, you are able to overcome much of that legacy of slavery, of Jim Crow.
When did the conversation start to change?
I can tell you that the movement to get rid of those symbols from the Civil War period basically started in to take a hold here in Hollywood with the name of those streets, those generals. What was refreshed was with Commissioner Dennis Moss pushed to try to rename Dixie Highway all the way across Florida.
Now, that's one of the challenges. This is how it gets complicated, because you have individual municipalities trying to get involved. And there was a push in Hallandale Beach by the vice mayor to change it. But there was pushback. Can the highway be changed by city, by municipality, or does it have to be across the county, across the state?
So it is actually in the city's domain to change it, except if it's a state highway. If it's a state highway, then the state has to give the okay. And even though it might be a county highway, if it is in a municipality, if it's in a city, the city has to initiate the effort to change the name also.
Have you had conversations with not just city officials, but with, you know, the residents of the community? And I wondered what those conversations are like. Have you heard from people who said they like it the way it is?
No, I haven't really heard from anyone directly that says they like it the way it is. But you have to understand that the constituents that I serve are mostly Black and minorities. So that's not the group that would be calling for it to remain the way it is. But overall, it's not been a overwhelming clamor to have it change either.
There are proposals to change a portion of it in Miami-Dade County to Harriet Tubman Expressway. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a good choice of name to change it to. Harriet Tubman symbolizes the expression of freedom, getting people free. It is the ideal of what the Constitution was supposed to be about, even though Blacks were not necessarily ones who were it was written for.
I mean, part of your job, obviously, is to address the racial and economic inequalities within the county. But, you know, as the mayor, as the county mayor, how do you do that? I mean, part, look, you can remove, you know, any symbols from the past. But as you were touching on before, you've got to try to find a way to improve the economic conditions for the communities of color in Broward. How are you going to do that?
That has been a huge focus of mine. And it's about opportunities. It's about watch how we spend the money and who we spend it with and how we can be more inclusive in that spend. When I got to the county, 10.25% of our procurement went to small business, which is our CBE program, which house or minority and women-owned businesses. Today, it's 39% because we broke contracts up. We removed restrictions that would have caused these small companies, these minority women-owned companies, not to be able to participate. We went out and recruit them. And if you watch any of the meetings, you will hear me talk about ensuring that we are not putting barriers in the way for these small companies to compete in. So that's one big piece of what we have to do. Because here's what I believe. If minority-owned companies are growing, then they're hiring from within those communities. So by empowering and growing these businesses, you're now growing the economy within those communities.
Again, that was Broward County Mayor Dale V.C. Holness, and talking about the debate around Dixie Highway, renaming it because, again, of its racist connotations and its Confederate past. We've been asking you, do you want to change the name of Dixie Highway? What would you call it instead, and why? And we've heard from a couple of you, some in support.
Hello, my name is Helen. I live in Miami. I agree with changing South Dixie Highway's name, and Harriet Tubman would be great. It was supposed to be on our, was it a $20 bill or $10 bill? I forget. But anyway, our administration has put that on hold, so let's do the highway. I heard that, I think somewhere up in Jupiter, they called it Obama. That would work too. I'm tired of all this racist history. Time to get rid of it. Thanks.
We also heard from Mike Curtis from Johnson City, Tennessee. He told us, I understand that something from one era can be racially insensitive in another, and if the residents want to change the name for that reason, they should change it. I just think it is helpful to know the history of the road before making a decision. Now, there are some who think we should keep the name Dixie.
My name is Tim Brown, and I grew up in the Miami area. And in response to the question regarding Dixie Highway, I would keep it the same, personally. I understand that the knee-jerk reaction these days is to completely erase it from our history and memory. But I see this as a very teachable moment, especially for the younger generation. When a child asks what and why is a particular street named a certain way, that gives us the opportunity to explain what happened and learn from it. Plus, given the costs involved with taking down all of the current signage, creating new one and installing it, I'd rather see that money go into educational programs so that people can better learn from our history and move forward. I personally think it is much more worthwhile to educate and learn from our past than to simply erase it.
Well, share with us your thoughts on the name of Dixie Highway. What should happen to it? Do you think the name should change? And what would you call it instead? Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, February 5th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie McCarthy-Powell. We get her thoughts on last night's State of the Union address, the impeachment vote today, and her focus on infrastructure and environmental protection in South Florida. Plus, Key West Mayor Terry Johnston joins us to discuss the issue of build-out in the Florida Keys, as well as updated flood maps, and there still is the sunscreen ban that could be overturned by the Florida legislature. And this election year, WLRN will be taking a look at an important voting block, young Latinos. Every 30 seconds, a Latino in the U.S. turns 18, which is voting age. And we'd like to hear from young Latinos in South Florida who will be voting for the first time this year. If that's you, we'd love to hear from you. Please text the word HELLO to 786-590-2262. That's HELLO to 786-590-2262. Well, that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.